Process.
Yeah, thank you very much. First, I'd of course like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this marvelous meeting, and also I should say that I particularly appreciate the cool and wet weather having come from the sun and heat of Europe. This is joint work by Dejan Milosevic and myself, and I was already alerted to some mistake here on my very first slide. I can assure you it won't be the only one. So, okay, this is work that has been going on for quite a while, and there have been many collaborators over the years. In particular, I would like to mention Dieter Bauer, now at Heidelberg, Gerhard Paulus, now at Texas, Richard Kopold, who is at Siemens in Regensburg in Germany, and Manfred Kleber from the Technical University of Munich. And also students of Dejan's have recently joined in this work. They are Asra Gazibegovic Buzulacic and Elvedin Hazovic. Briefly, what I would like to do, this is, mostly I'm, to a good part, I will just review the good old strong field approximation. And I actually would like to derive it for you at the risk of putting everyone asleep this early in the day, because I would like to point out really what it can do at what and what it can't. But the central topic would be what we call quantum orbits, and I'll show you various examples for those, long pulses, short pulses, etc. And if I have time left in the end, I will turn to definite shortcomings of the strong field approximation, one being the question which gauge to use, and also Coulomb effects. Okay, so let me derive this for you. I mean, we start from just the transition amplitude, exact, from an initial bound state, the laser pulse has not arrived yet, to a final continuum state of the same potential, and the laser pulse is gone, and this is mediated by the exact time evolution operator. Now, there are these Dyson equations for the exact time evolution operator, where you iterate with respect to either the interaction with the laser field, and you start from the exact propagator of the electron in the Coulomb field, or later vice versa, you can do it the other way around. You start from the exact Volkoff propagator and iterate with respect to the binding potential. So you insert this here, and the first term cancels because the initial and final state are orthogonal, and you wind up with this form here, which is still exact. Okay, I do not even refrain from showing you the Volkoff functions, which are sort of the basic building block of all analytical modeling in this field. And what I would like to point out is that the Volkoff solutions actually are not by any means restricted to a monochromatic field. They hold for any time-dependent field. Relativistically, they would hold for any field which is a plane wave field. And so does the entire formalism I'm going to show you. Okay, so then this is the form we just had. And now comes the very, very drastic approximation of the strong field approximation. In this form here, this is a continuum state of the binding potential. We are going to replace it by a plane wave, and this is the exact time evolution operator, and we are going to replace it by the Volkoff operator, by the Volkoff time evolution operator. That way, and we are getting this form here, which now has a Volkoff state, and the interaction with the field, and it's equivalent to this form here, where the electron field interaction has been replaced by the binding potential. So if you look at what has been done, of course, I mean, you have dropped almost everything in the problem. Because now, I mean, the electron goes into the continuum right away after just one interaction with the laser field. And after that, it doesn't feel the binding potential anymore. So, I mean, all the things that have been dropped are first, of course, the ground state. And the ground state normally is sort of modified by the laser field before the electron gets out. I mean, there are, of course, dark shifts. It will be depleted. There are interactions with intermediate states. All of this is gone. And, by the way, some of these things can be healed by hand. So, for example, if you want to introduce the stark shift of the ground state, it's not in this formula, but it's kind of near at hand just to introduce it by hand. I mean, then it's no longer an exact derivation, but, you can try to heal some of the shortcomings here by hand. Then, of course, I mean, quantum mechanics is gauge invariant, but approximations aren't necessarily. So here you have lost gauge invariance. And apart from the initial ground state, all interaction with the Coulomb field for an atom is eliminated. So, I mean, I like to discriminate between soft Coulomb effects, where the electron is only marginally deflected or affected, and hard Coulomb effects, which would include rescattering, where the electron state is really drastically modified. Okay, the latter can be healed. Okay, let's turn to rescattering. And again, this is the exact form that I had before. But now, before I replace all of this by the final Volkoff state, I use a Dyson equation with respect to the atomic potential. And then I get two terms from this and from that. And now I have included one, just one more interaction with the atomic potential. So this is, I would call this, okay, let's move to the next slide. It gives you one compact form, but for many purposes, a different form is better, this one, which has now the first term. This is what we had before. I call this direct electrons because they leave the, they never see the ion anymore after ionization. And this here includes now rescattering. You see the electron is ionized, propagates in the field, but now returns to within the binding potential, and only then does it take off in a Volkoff state. Okay, here, this is again the binding potential. I mean, there's only, this is single active electron approximation, so there's only one binding potential, and that should be everywhere. However, again, you can try to introduce improvements by hand. So, I mean, rather than taking the binding potential here, we could take some scattering potential that we get from data of electron ion scattering or something. And we have done this quite often, and this improves the agreement with the data by a long shot. So now what we have done is, I mean, we have restored the hard Coulomb effects for rescattering to first order Born approximation. All the rest is still gone. Okay, how to evaluate this actually? So let's concentrate for a minute on the direct electrons. This is the entire matrix element, which is integrated over all time, so over the entire laser pulse. And you can separate it into the what we call the form factor. That's essentially the Fourier transform of the binding potential and the exponential of the action. This here is periodic. Let's first consider a very long periodic pulse. Then this here is periodic. And if we move on in the field by one cycle, then here the action picks up this additional term. So in a long periodic pulse, the action is periodic up to this term here. Now if you recall the standard formula for sum of exponentials that give you a delta function, then we can do the sum over all the cycles exactly. So we sum here over all the cycles and get a delta function that expresses energy conservation, the standard function. What's left is the integral over just one cycle of the pulse. If you wish, you can say that, I mean, all energies of the electron that do not satisfy this energy conserving condition have disappeared by destructive interference. And you get the standard spectrum here. Now this one here, we can do exactly, but it's much more instructive to evaluate it by stationary phase. Okay, the phase is stationary for times that satisfy this condition here. If the binding energy is small, you immediately retrieve here the streaking condition. So the drift momentum of the electron is equal to the vector potential at the time of ionization. It's modified by this term so that the times actually then become complex, because obviously you cannot satisfy this for real times. Okay, so what we have at this point then is the energy conserving delta function and a sum over the saddle point solutions of one cycle. Now, this was for a long pulse. Suppose we have a few cycle pulse, then obviously you're not going to get this delta function. And basically you have to just sum over all saddle point solutions over the entire length of the pulse. Okay, so the picture is this for a long pulse. Here is the laser pulse, and we have eliminated the sum over all the cycles, and this gives a discrete line spectrum here. And now the envelope of the pulse is determined by the, in general, two solutions within one cycle. So in this case here, if we are interested in a drift momentum of P, again, we have to find by the streaking condition P equal EA, we would get two solutions here, and these solutions interfere, and that generates here the envelope of the spectrum. If you have a very short pulse, then basically this, okay, this would at the same time be approximately just not discrete, the spectrum of just one cycle of the laser field, without any peaks, of course. Okay, we have found the times when the electron gets out into the field, and once we know the starting time, the field is no longer there, we can just by the standard Newton's force calculate the orbits of the electron. And here is a laser pulse, the electric field, and for given momentum, here we have two solutions. So in one case, the electron gets out here, and the second it gets out here. It does not get out at the origin automatically, the formalism does it for us. It starts its orbit at the, what I call the exit of the tunnel. And now these, in the strong field approximation, these orbits are treated identically, but you see here one very important thing. I mean, this orbit here goes to the detector right away. This one here, however, crosses, it has to go over the nucleus, over the ion, and this is not incorporated in the strong field approximation. So at this point we are going to make a mistake, because quite obviously this orbit here will somehow interact with the nucleus, and this one won't, and it's not in the formalism. I'll come back to this if I have time. Okay, let's compare this with the data. Here are data, ionization of F minus by Hans-Peter Helm's group in Freiburg. And okay, this here is the data. And this here is a theory. We take a slightly higher intensity than in the data. And it's focal averaged. So here you see the ATI peaks. And here you see this dip here, which we ascribe to interference of the two solutions within one cycle. Okay, turning to rescattering now, we do the same. Again, we use a saddle point approximation. We combine all the heavily, the quickly oscillating factors into one action. And now here we integrate over the immediate momentum, over the ionization time, over the final time. So that gives the three saddle point and conditions, which refer to the instant of ionization. This here makes sure that the electron does return to the ion. And this here makes sure that then it scatters elastically off the ion. And we solve this and can then expand the amplitude in terms of these solutions. So, I mean, conceptually, this is very straightforward, because the only thing basically we have to do is to solve these saddle point equations and plug it into the expression and sum over the solutions. So, of course, solving these saddle point solutions is not always so terribly easy. And so what we have is the quantum orbit expansion. And we can really, this is the action over these quantum orbits. We have the start times, the rescattering times. So these are now very simple orbits in space and time. And okay, let me show how they look like. So here are rescattered quantum orbits. Again, you see that they come out at some time, and then they follow the field, which is given here in green. When the field turns around, they return to the ion. And then they rescatter and go to the detector. And the exact shape depends on the energy at the detector that you will have. Okay, let me show you some... okay, there's one question here. When you have an orbit start at a particular time, here are electron orbits in the field. And depending upon at which time in the field they start, they may never return to the ion. They may return several times, or they may even return infinitely often. And all of these return times are legitimate solutions of the saddle point equation. So we have to include them into the formalism. And the question is, what will their effect be? I mean, normally in harmonic generation, you recall that only the shortest two orbits are considered, called the short orbit or the long orbit. But Ludi Morrow has shown yesterday that at least for long wavelengths, the late returns are very, very important and very visible. So So let me show you the effects that they make. Here we build up some ATI spectrum from these quantum orbits. They are given, the contributions are here given on the same scale. So these are the two shortest orbits here. These are the next two, the longer orbits, longer by half a period, and so on. So you see that the contribution really of each pair of orbits is normally small compared with the first. But if you superpose them, I mean, this is in the amplitude. So in the amplitude, it may be different. I'll show you examples. In this case here, I mean, this would be the spectrum generated by the two shortest orbits. If you include this pair here, then it looks like this. So there are modifications here. And if you include this additional pair here, you get this. And this, in this case, is pretty much like the final exact result. So in many cases, the long orbits here don't make much of a difference. But there are important exceptions, which I'll turn to next. But before I do that, let me come to a few cycle pulses. These are ATI spectra for a 7-cycle sine square cosine pulse, and in two opposite directions, parallel and anti-parallel to the laser field. And you see, okay, as you know, that they are very different. I mean, the cutoffs are different, and in particular, the structure here is very different. I mean, here we have something like an ATI spectrum with discrete peaks, and in the opposite direction, we don't. So we can understand all of this in all gory detail by looking at the responsible quantum orbits. Here it is. It's a bit complicated. Again, here's the entire spectrum, and I probably shouldn't try to explain it in all detail. Here are the respective quantum orbits. And now, for a short pulse, it's much more complicated than for a long pulse. For example, I mean, these orbits that you see here would be identical for a long pulse. For a 7-cycle pulse, they are different. And so, okay, let me just explain one thing here. For example, here you have this peak structure, which comes from the fact that you have two quantum orbits. Here's a light blue one, and the other one is this kind of yellowish one. And they are depicted here. Here is let's see, where is it? And it's B. This here is one, and this here is this one. And you see they rescatter at times that differ by about one cycle of the laser field. So what you in effect have here is a double slit, and you get interference and generate this ATI spectrum. In the opposite direction here, there's only one pair of orbits with a high cutoff. So in fact, only one. This has to be discarded. And so the spectrum here is completely featureless. So affects all these interferences, everything can be understood in terms of these quantum orbits. Okay, let me turn to a different example, which is very ancient again, but I like it a lot. This is elliptical polarization, fairly large ellipticity, and this is a spectrum. And now the standard orbit that ionizes and returns now actually is only responsible for the highest energy part of the spectrum. And more complicated orbits are much stronger and make up for the low energy part. The reason is that for elliptical polarization, an electron doesn't return to the nucleus unless it has an appropriate initial velocity, and then it can return, but it has to pay a heavy price for this because, it's exponentially suppressed. And here you need a particularly large transverse momentum. For this long orbit here, the corresponding momentum is much smaller, and so this here is dominant for low energies. This has been seen experimentally by Gerhard Paulus. And so here's a spectrum taken for elliptical polarization. And you see here the contributions of the various orbits. If you are really benevolent, you can even believe that this part of the spectrum is due to this very complicated orbit here, which takes off and then passes a nucleus, returns, passes a nucleus again, and only finally recombines. This is one case, and let me summarize at this point what we have achieved. I mean, this is all S-matrix theory, and S-matrix theory is a black box, which you are not supposed to look into. So, I mean, you prescribe the initial state, and the S-matrix, the formalism cranks out the final state, and you are not supposed to know what happens in between. And the quantum orbits now actually allow you really to look into this box. And what we have achieved by this formalism is really a spatio-temporal picture of what happens in between the initial and the final state. And so this is my excuse that I dare to talk about this as an attosecond conference. I have no attosecond pulses, but I mean all this dynamics here in the meantime proceeds on a on the scale of a cycle of the laser field, which is well in the attosecond regime. And also, of course, I mean this offers the potential for control. I mean, if I may go back to the elliptical polarization case here, if somehow, I mean, you could block here, if you could put something here, some obstacle or so, then suppose, I mean, okay, you put something here that absorbs these orbits, then, I mean, this step here of the staircase would just drop out like a step of a staircase breaks. So in principle, this is thinkable, and this formalism allows you at least to learn what you would have to do in order to achieve this. Okay, let me turn to another thing, which again is ancient, but it's in my opinion, it's one of the most fascinating aspects of ADI, and that is these intensity-dependent enhancements. They were measured by Phil Buxbaum and by Lynn van Borkum's groups way back in the last millennium. And the point is, here's an ADI spectrum, part of it, and okay, it has a certain peak intensity. Now you increase this peak intensity by just a little more than 5%. And this group of peaks here rears up by almost an order of magnitude. Okay, later similar experiments were done by Gerhard Paulus. And okay, let me turn to the explanation in terms of the quantum orbit formalism. First, I mean, at some the quantum orbit formalism really is something like a zero-range atom in disguise, and we never expected that such a simple system would produce such a complicated effect, but we did the calculation anyway, and you see exactly the same thing here. The intensity increases from here to here by some 7% or so, and this group of peaks here jumps up and then later deflates again. And the interesting thing is here that I mentioned that normally you don't need too many orbits, 3, 4, 5, 6, in order to get a good description of the final result. But in this case, it turns out, in order to get this enhancement here, we needed to include exceptionally many orbits. I mean, here we don't need many, and again, at the higher intensity, we don't need many, but here we needed many, many more, that's shown here. So the conclusion was that first, I mean, this happens at intensities that correspond to a channel closing. When n photons are just enough to supply the binding energy and the ponderomotive energy, but no more. So that then the ionized electron has zero momentum. So we are in this case that the electron returns infinitely often to the nucleus. And at each return, it has two options in quantum mechanics. It can decide to ignore the nucleus and just go on. Or it can decide to rescatter. And so at some point, then it will finally rescatter and get off. And now what we see here in this case is a constructive interference of all these long orbits. And it's interference, so it's a quantum effect. I mean, basically, by and large, the origin of the plateau is classical, but this effect is definitely a quantum effect. And I mean, the fact that all these long orbits are in phase at channel closings can actually be shown analytically. This is just one explanation of this effect. I mean, there's another approach by Nikolai Manakov and Tony Starris, which is pretty much similar in spirit to ours, except it's exact. And actually, at that time, we derived a lot of satisfaction from seeing the same effects in this model, because before that, sometimes I figured maybe we are just pursuing some artifacts of the approximation. So Tony's work showed that this was real. And there's a seemingly totally different explanation, which proceeds via, if I summarize it in one phrase, multiphoton resonance with ponderomotively upshifted Rydberg states. Now the fact is, in this approach, there are no Rydberg states. So basically, I mean, okay, let me show one more thing about these here. Here's okay. Let me move on. Here's an extreme effect. Well, this is a harmonic generation here. In order to produce the final answer, you need more than 100 orbits. Interesting thing is that I showed you this is in our interpretation, it's a constructive interference of long orbits. So the implication is if you have a real short pulse, the effect goes away, and indeed it does. I mean, these are unpublished data by Gerhard Paulus' group, where the pulse intensity decreases here from top to bottom, and you see that the enhancements go away. Okay. If you combine all these effects I have been talking about, then you get focal averaged angular resolved ATI energy spectra. Here's an example. This is for xenon. And okay, here is the emission angle, here is the energy. And this is now already quite complicated. It's strong field approximation, but you know exactly what's in here. And again, if you look at it with some leisure, then you can understand all of the features that you see here in terms of several elements. One is again the channel closings that I was talking about. So that's responsible, for example, for enhancements here. This is focal averaged. And so that means that the spectrum will invariably always include some contributions from channel closings. In this case, I think they are here in the middle. They depend on the angle, so they also move outward. The second effect that is in here, which is responsible for essentially these, you see the intensity here is a bit higher than in the middle. This is the essentially rainbow scattering. It's the cutoffs. The 10 UP cutoffs, and the same as a function of angle. I mean, right classically, it's like the rainbow. The intensity is particularly high before the feature disappears. And this survives in quantum mechanics. That's responsible for this. Then we have all these interferences, which are by and large due to constructive or destructive interference of two orbits of a pair. And all of this is in here. So this we understand, and so by comparing this to the data, I hope one can learn something and find out what is not. I mean, effects that are not contained in the strong field approximation. How much time do I have? Oh, 10 minutes, great. So do I have 10 minutes, including questions? Okay, let me just come to briefly touch these two aspects. I mentioned initially that in the strong field approximation, the gauge invariance is last. So this leads to the question which gauge to use, and I'm far from answering it because it may well depend on the situation. Let me just show you one example where we have looked at it. This is again ionization of negative ions, and this is the Schrödinger equation, exact solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, numerical, and this is a strong field approximation. This one here is in length gauge. The inset is in velocity gauge. You see here the black line is ionization from a 1s ground state, and the dotted red line is ionization from a 2p state. And you see that the maxima are basically here out of phase in the Schrödinger equation. The same is the case in the strong field approximation in length gauge, but not in velocity gauge. So this is a nice qualitative effect, which very clearly in this case tells you you should use length gauge. The same conclusion also has been reached by Nikolai Manakov and Tony Starwis in this case. In general, it's not so. This here, the blue dots are data by Hans-Peter Helm. And here again, we did the same thing. There's another thing you can do. You can also tamper with the initial bound state wave function. After all, this is not hydrogen. So the question is what to take for that. Here we compare two choices, asymptotic wave functions like this, essentially zero range wave functions and Hartree-Fock wave functions. And the depressing conclusion is that basically here, if you allow yourself to play with the intensity, then all three cases here work with the sole exception of velocity gauge and Hartree-Fock wave function. So it's not very easy to arrive at conclusions in this issue by comparison with the data. Okay, finally, leaving the SFA, it does not include the Coulomb field. For negative ions, this is not really a problem. Not a brief argument. Okay, maybe I can try. Ask me again. Okay, then I'll try. Coulomb effects, again, we compared with solutions of the TDSE, and this is for a short pulse. The solid line is the Schrödinger equation. The dotted line is the strong field approximation. And basically, I was struck by the fact how good the agreement in general is. Here, we can identify two problem areas. First, of course, for real low energies, you don't really expect the SFA to work. The effect of the Coulomb field is just too strong. But here is some area in between. This is a kind of tricky area because it's above the classical cutoff of 2UP and below the rescattering plateau. You see in the rescattering plateau here, the agreement is just excellent. In between, there is a problem region, and in particular, these interferences of the two solutions within one cycle do not show in the Schrödinger equation. Okay, moving on. Okay, Andrew showed this yesterday here. Actually, he ascribed this calculation to us, but it's yours. Anyhow, this is the left-right asymmetry of a short pulse. And in the SFA, you expect that you have symmetry for a cosine pulse. If you include the Coulomb potential, the symmetry point is moved away here by pi over 3, which almost seems like some universal constant or so. So this is, again, a nice qualitative effect where the Coulomb potential does show. Okay, maybe I finish with this. We have here, try to understand this intuitively, I have no idea whether this explanation is true, but in the SFA, we want to compare backward forward. So we have two different momenta, establishing the ionization times from the streaking condition, we would have to ionize at this point here and at this point here. The electric field is of the carrier wave is identical here. So you would expect symmetry. But now look at the electron orbits. I mean, the one here moves away straight away. This is the electron orbit in the field. This is position. This is time. Now the other one, it first starts off identically because the field is the same. But then the field turns around in this case here. It goes through zero, turns around. So this one interacts with the nucleus. Now this interaction in 3D will be a focusing. The contribution of this orbit we expect to be stronger. And in order to offset this, we would have to move the envelope with respect to the carrier wave, to this one here. This I have checked it about 5 times. This gives the right sign of the effect. I don't know if the explanation is correct. And with this I should finish. Thank you very much.
So this paper is now open for questions.
In your comparison between the SFA and the TDSE on the left and right?
Yeah, no, okay, yeah.
Presumably you normalize the spectra with respect to each other, right?
Yes. So, I mean, there was some normalization free. We took the liberty of moving the spectra around because we never calculate absolute weights.
Anyway, it's kind of intriguing because I remember, so in the high energy region where rescattering is supposed to play some role, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be included in your second order calculation.
Yeah.
If you do the real calculation using the second order, it seems the second order will be the dominant in the high energy region, energy region.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this allows for just one rescattering.
Yeah.
I mean, the electron may revisit the nucleus more than once. Okay, but only in one case, in one and only one case, is it allowed to interact with the nucleus by the formalism.
But that means that the electron energy shape basically the same in the from the first order and the second order, or what?
No. I mean, the plateau is generated by this one hard Coulomb collision. I mean, Tony can...
If I could make a comment, we've also done essentially exact calculations for a zero-range potential with arbitrary polarization, and we find that high on the ATI plateau, the approximation of treating rescattering once is fine. But when you get right at the onset of the plateau, the low energy part of the ATI plateau, you can be off by significant factors without including multiple rescattering.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can, it's in principle, it's no problem to go on to second order Born approximation. But of course, I mean, it's the labor would be significantly higher. We haven't done it. And we know by comparison with Tony's work essentially what to expect.
Any other questions?
You just mentioned in response to one question that you never calculate absolute rates.
Yeah.
Why not?
Basically because I don't trust the strong field approximation very much when it comes to absolute weights. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, Armin Squincy yesterday was, okay, this you can derive ADK directly from the strong field approximation, so that's all the same. Armin yesterday was saying that in general he was amazed how well it works. I just don't know. I mean, we are interested in the spectrum and not so much in the absolute weights. And I mean, first, the strong field approximation, like I showed you, the electron is in the continuum after one interaction with the field, and then kind of the Volkov solution has to do all the hard work, I mean, roll up the sleeves and move the electron really up into the continuum. In reality, I mean, there are resonances in between, all kind of stuff, and none of that is part of the strong field approximation. But once the electron is in the continuum, then again it's fine. So the spectrum typically is very well approximated by the SFA. The absolute weights I wouldn't trust.
Well, still I would find it interesting to compare with the exact solution of the TDSC. Sometimes
yeah.
one has surprises.
I don't really. And also, I mean, the thing is that are these absolute weights very well known experimentally? Is there anything you can?
Yeah. Yeah, we have been checking that the comparison between this SFA and the TDSE solution. Actually, SFA usually is too small. Can be a factor 2, sometimes can be up to a factor 200. It's intensity dependent and system dependent. So it's really a problem, you know. The absolute value usually is wrong. Now, if you compare with the tunneling ionization theory, the tunnel ionization theory typical would be within a factor 2, you know, in the total rate. So that's, but in terms of the electron distribution, the difference is, we don't say it's very small.
Well, and while we're piling on the SFA, and you invited this, the other thing that, I mean, there is this question of the absolute rates, and that's, of course, interesting, but one can sort of argue that away, either by saying the experiments don't measure it, or we'll just normalize it to the experiment. But the other thing that you find, and I think this is more significant with the comparison with more exact calculations, is the relative weights of the different trajectories that the SFA predicts and that you find out of the TDSE are often very different. And so, for instance, this is why it would be interesting to do experiments where we see, for instance, long trajectories and harmonic generation, because you get very different predictions out of the two theories for what are the relative weights of long and short and longer trajectories. And these are, I think this really makes sense. I mean, the SFA and the, identifying what are the quantum orbits is something that is, that the SFA is very good at, and what are the characteristics of these orbits? Very good at that. What is the weight of these orbits, which comes from that stability matrix? That's very sensitive, and that's really where the big differences, in my opinion, are.
And this is actually the fact, I guess, where the SFA is well understood, and the actual weights will be different, will come out differently out of the Schrödinger equation. And here is finally where you can learn something about atomic physics. I mean, Anne Lhuillier was raising the question yesterday, basically what can be learned from this? And by comparing the weights of the orbits, you can really, this is atomic physics. Also, I mean, the way then, for example, the I showed you these different ATI peaks, which here come out basically with a separation of H bar omega. Now, if you tamper with the weights of the orbits, then the energy separation can vary by the energy separation can vary by 10-20%. And again, this and also the experimental data shows the separation for short few cycle pulses not to be exactly H bar omega. So that's another point where something can be learned, I guess.
Well, let's thank the speaker again for a very stimulating talk.